he I think he wrote a second letter. And as I say, that was innocuous. And we wrote back one that was equally innocuous, saying we're not interested.
How were you taking all this?
Well, my first time through this, so I,
Were you losing sleep?
Didn't know. I really don't think so, but I don't normally lose sleep over stuff, so I don't think I was losing sleep over it, but I was, it had my attention, I'll tell you that. So at any rate, I don't think he even withdrew his offer because it's such a fuzzy offer. There was no way we could take it up at some time later if we wanted to. There was nothing to take up in this letter offer that he sent us. So it turns out that he had violated a rule or several rules of the SEC in this offer, in his actions, because he bought some stock of ours and did not register appropriately with the SEC like you're supposed to. So we learned of this, we protested, the SEC investigated, and they ultimately fined him, and he paid the fine, or his company did, Mesa. But none of our shareholders got anything. The government took it, the fine. And the sense of the violation was it disadvantaged our shareholders because of his action. And instead of our shareholders getting something from him, the government took it, which made us even madder. So at any rate,
did you ever meet him face to face?
Never met him, but sort of the postscript to this little saga was that I was down in San Antonio, Texas. We held a luncheon for investors. San Antonio is quite a wealthy area, so there's a lot of investors down there. A lot of the companies go there to talk to their investors. So I was down in San Antonio at a luncheon that we gave for investors. There must have been 50 or 60 folks that came. While I was waiting there, our CFO was setting up the slide projector and all of that in the luncheon room. And so I was just sort of walking around this club. It was the top floor of a bank building in San Antonio. And I was just walking around looking out the windows on from the various sides of the city. And this big guy walks up behind me and he says, "Hi." And I said, "Hi." He said, and I turned around and looked at him and I thought, he looks a little familiar. He said, "First time in the city?" And I said, "Yeah, first time up here for sure, in this building." And he said, "Quite a view, isn't it?" And I said, "Yeah, it's a heck of a view." He said, "You going to this lunch?" And I said, "Yeah, you?" By this time I knew who it was.
You recognized him from what picture?
Well, it must have been a picture, because I knew who it was. He said, "Nah, I'm not going to the meeting. I'm a member here at this club or something." And it was Ken Batchelder. And he was Boone Pickens' takeover guy. And I think he was his chief financial officer too, but He was the takeover guy. He did all the nuts and bolts of this stuff and thought out the strategies and all this stuff for Pickens. But he didn't know who I was, which is interesting. If they were willing to spend $1.5 billion or something for a company, you'd think they at least would have looked at an annual report or something, see what the guy looked like that they were going to kick out. But he didn't recognize me. So I thought
he wasn't just pretending not to.
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think so. And there's no way to know for sure.
But I
didn't think so. And what that told me was they weren't serious about taking us over. Mm-hmm. They just going to run us up against the wall if they could, get money out of us, and take off. Mm-hmm. And so they had no intention of taking us over, which was sort of their game. So that was sort of that was the end of all of that.
So how did you ultimately fight them off?
That was it. It was gone. They didn't come back. And we said, no thanks, we're not interested, and they didn't come back. Mm-hmm. And then there was a subsequent investigation. It took 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. For the SEC to finally do what they did, but by the time I met him in San Antonio, it was all done.
All gone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was an exciting time. That was an exciting time.
Yeah. It was. This is the Examiner. I don't know. I don't take the Examiner, so I don't know where this came from, but. Anyway,
I don't.
That's where he planted his story, I guess.
I probably went to the journal.
It was probably in every.
Yeah, certainly in the major.
It was big news.
Papers, yeah, mm-hmm. New York Times and the Journal. And such as that.
Okay, so.
Now, interestingly enough, Batchelder left Pickens finally and started his own boutique. Consulting firm out of someplace in Southern California. And later became associated with Santa Fe Railroad, who had acquired the Southern Pacific. So now it's Santa Fe Southern Pacific at this time. And advised Santa Fe, Southern Pacific, on the Homestake offer to acquire Santa Fe Gold. Just, what was it, 3 years ago or mm-hmm. 4 or 3, whatever it was. So he showed up again in that, on the other side of the table, on that transaction. So it's sort of a small world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do want to get into that Santa Fe Gold thing, but perhaps later, or should
okay.
you want to do it now? Maybe.
That's really that's good. Quite a bit later in time. Later. This is 81, and that was 96 or so. Mm-hmm. So, where should we go next?
Well,
maybe
where
that
do you
is.
Think? You had said last time you wanted to go to Corona, and I thought that we
Corona's
should
92.
Fill in other things before
sure.
we did
okay.
Corona.
Okay.
We can
so.
Jump up to Santa Fe since it's relevant now.
Okay.
However you think.
Well, why don't we
kind of go back and forth?
Just tie
I had intended to ask you where Dick Store came into all that because Warfield, Warburg.
Well, that was
pre-Warburg.
81 was pre-Warburg.
Yeah, but the Santa Fe.
Oh, Santa Fe.
Thing later.
Yeah.
That's a
yeah.
quite
well, see,
a story, but we could do that now.
Okay.
We're talking about acquisitions and
takeovers
and those kinds of things.
Yes. So that, and to tie into what I just said about mm-hmm. Batchelder, the Santa
By this time you were
I was
chairman.
No, yeah, I was no longer chief executive
no,
by this time.
Thompson.
So this really, because you know, one day you'll be doing his.
Mm-hmm.
So he of course is much closer to all of the ins and outs
on
of this
firing line
than I.
More.
So I did, but maybe just a synopsis of of that. Santa Fe Gold had was the outgrowth of the fact that the Santa Fe, and particularly the Southern Pacific Railroad, owned huge tract of land through Nevada, which was given to it by the it's 10:30.
Okay.
We're gonna have to move.
All right, we had to move down the hall. We were meeting in the conference room, and now we've moved back to your office, and we've jumped ahead to.
Yeah, we carried on with the thought of the Santa Fe Gold, which was the outgrowth of exploration work that was done by the Santa Fe people on the Southern Pacific right-of-way through Nevada, which went through a very, very prospective area for gold. And so the Santa Fe people had an exploration office in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and it was headed up by a fellow named Dick Zitting. Dick Zitting and our people, Langswent and Dick Store, and those of our homestake people that worked in Grants knew Dick, because in his early days he was also in the uranium business, and I forget what
Santa
company.
Santa Fe were one of the first people in there with
that's
Ace,
right, with
Ace
that, again, right away.
Mm-hmm.
They had right away land. Mm-hmm. And so Dick Zitting was doing that for Santa Fe. So he and Lang and Dick Store all knew each other.
And Dick Store was on the Santa Fe board.
And later, after the Santa Fe fellas had had good success in exploration on their land in Nevada, immediately adjacent to Twin Creek, or to I'm going to forget the name of the Goldfields discovery. It may come to me in a minute, but the Santa Fe property, I think, was just to the south of that. They did drilling on their property to the south of Chimney Creek.
Mm.
Chimney Creek, which was the Goldfields discovery, which was put into operations by this time. The Santa Fe fellas discovered what proved to be a continuation of the Twin Creek ore body. Twin Creek ore body. And so subsequently, those properties were merged into one mine, which is now called Rabbit Creek. The Santa Fe discovery was Rabbit Creek. The Goldfields discovery was Twin Creeks. They merged the two. Chimney Creek, and they merged it into what is now called Twin Creeks.
I see.
They twinned the creeks.
Mm, okay.
So there was this very, very low cost, large reserved gold mine that Santa Fe owned. And when I say Santa Fe in this context, I'm talking about the parent company, Santa Fe Southern Pacific Railroad. They decided, the management of the railroad decided, that they should spin off the gold mine and the gold mining activities. They had a gold mine in the Imperial Valley in California as well, open pit, low grade gold mine. And it those mines they put into a company called Santa Fe Gold, which they then spun off to their shareholders, and spun it off in such a way that for a period of 2 years, it was impossible for another company to take over the newly created public company, Santa Fe Gold. They, of course, as a public company, had a board of directors, and one of the people on that board of directors was Dick Storr. He was invited to go on the board, which is another unique part of Dick Storr. He was known to be a confidant of mine, a consultant to me, and still was asked to go on the Santa Fe board. And the thing we all know about Dick is that he would not compromise any entity with which he's associated at the expense of another entity. And so that's just another demonstration of the character of Dick. But at any rate, he was at one of the directors of the Santa Fe board. Dick Sitting retired shortly after the formation of the company, and a fellow named Pat James took over as chief executive, very capable mining man, and he was then CEO and running the company. By the time the 2 years then elapsed, and now the structure that they had created disappeared such that the company could be sold. A third party could come in, and if the management didn't want to sell the company that wished to acquire them could do it on an unfriendly basis. And all of this then set up what turned out to be an auction to buy the company, and Homestake, with early discussions between Jack Thompson, who was now CEO of Homestake, president and CEO, had extended conversations with Pat James. I had taken Jack down to Albuquerque and introduced him to Pat because I knew Pat before this time, and Jack hadn't met him. And so I introduced the two of them in
Where
Albuquerque.
Where did the idea come from?
It's an idea that we all had, because the Southern Pacific owned so much land in Nevada, and Nevada has turned out to be such a gold province that you just would like to have that land in your portfolio to explore. Plus, they had these very low-cost gold mines, so it was an idea that everybody had. It was nothing proprietary about it. The only trick was, could you do it? Could you pull it off? Because it was so obviously attractive to any gold mining company. And so Jack and Pat James had subsequent meetings, and I'm not privy to those in detail. I just know that they got along well. They had a lot in common. They could see a lot of synergies in putting Homestake and Santa Fe together into one company. So I think by and large the management could see a real advantage in that merger. We were not the only ones that were interested, obviously. And the other company that was most aggressively interested was Newmont Mining Company. And of course, Newmont is a very large operator in Nevada, and felt that because of their presence in Nevada, their large presence, contrasted with Homestake's, which was much less than Newmont's, that they should be the ones that could bring a lot of synergy to the table by putting their company and Santa Fe Gold together. So there was the usual shootout at the OK Corral for this. One of the things that the Homestake team was able to negotiate with the board of Santa Fe Gold, first of all, they did negotiate a deal that was announced, and Santa Fe Gold announced that they were going to accept Homestake's offer to acquire Santa Fe Gold. And I don't remember what the premium was, but it was a good premium.
Well, I have some newspaper clippings, but...
Yeah, but it was a good premium. Certainly 30%, if not more, over the price of Santa Fe Gold at the time of the offer. Also, as part of the agreement for Homestake to acquire Santa Fe Gold, was a... breakup fee being one which if some third party came in, made a better offer than Homestake, and Homestake didn't feel it could or didn't want to increase its offer, in order for Santa Fe Gold to break its agreement with Homestake, they would have to pay Homestake $65 million as a breakup fee. So this deal for Homestake to acquire Santa Fe Gold was achieved over a weekend. It was announced the following Monday, and within a day or so, Newmont, and it may have been longer than that, but not much longer, Newmont came in with a much higher offer than the Homestake Santa Fe agreed offer. And so Homestake evaluated that because of Newmont's greater presence in Nevada. They obviously were hoping to get a lot out of the synergy that they said they saw in their combination with Santa Fe Gold, because at the price they offered, it was difficult to justify Homestake matching or beating that offer. So Homestake opted not to raise its bid. And turned out shortly thereafter that Newmont paid Homestake $65 million for the breakup fee and acquired Santa Fe. So that was a case where we lost that opportunity, but at least pocketed $65 million in cash for having been in the game. Now, sort of a postscript on that, one of the arguments for the high price that both Homestake and then subsequently Newmont were willing to pay for this company was this vast tract of land that the Southern Pacific Railroad owned in Nevada, and the hope that it would contain some new ore bodies yet to be discovered, because without that, the price that was paid for the company didn't have a sound economic basis. Only with the addition of reserves could you hope to make that acquisition financially attractive. And to this point, which is now, 4 years later, 3 years later anyhow, Newmont has not announced any success with their drilling program. And so that story is incomplete yet as to how successful that acquisition is going to be. It'll have to wait for further developments. So that was that acquisition which didn't happen on the Homestake side.
Was there any other fallout for Homestake other than the $65 million?
No, not that I recall. We must have spent
stockholders' reaction.
No. I think the market generally applauded the outcome of that. I don't recall, but I would have bet that when we stepped away from that, our stock price probably went up. It had probably been discounted some because we were going to issue stock to acquire the company. And the Santa Fe shareholders would have been substantial shareholders in the new company versus the Homestake shareholders. We'd have had to issue so much stock. So I don't just recall now, but I imagine the stock price probably went up after it was announced that we were not going to do that, which is not unusual. So we sort of hopped ahead. We'd been talking back in 81, and then now we came up to this activity in 95 or 96.
And we had just said, while we were moving here, I had a little intermission also, that 80 had also been a crucial year, in a way even more so maybe than 81, but I had picked 81.
Well, 80 was extraordinary in that we had such high gold prices. Mm-hmm. Lead and zinc prices were not at an all-time high, but certainly were very high, again because of the high inflation that the country was seeing at that time.
That was when you announced the McLaughlin.
And that's when we announced the McLaughlin, which was a fun thing because the all of the excitement about gold. That was later in 80, in August, as I recall, that we announced McLaughlin.
Right.
Gold price had been $850 just 7 months earlier. It had fallen off to about $600, but that was still extraordinary price for gold by anybody's reckoning at that point. And then we announced a new gold find in California. And our stock, we announced it at the close of the market on the day we announced it, I forget what day. And so the next morning, they couldn't open our stock on the market because there were more buy orders than sell, and so they couldn't match their book. And for 45 minutes, our stock didn't trade because there weren't enough sellers to match the buyers of the stock. So that was all heady stuff, and I think our stock opened up about 10 points higher than it had been. Which might have been in the 40s at that time. I just forget where it was, but it was a substantial increase when they finally could clear the book for buyers and sellers. So that was exciting stuff. But that year, 1980, because of the high gold price, I think it averaged nearly $600 for the year. Lead and zinc prices were high. We were still enjoying the benefit of our uranium contracts, which by now had escalated well over $20 a pound, some as high as $40 a pound. Our uranium business was extremely profitable. We netted $100 million that year, over $100 million, which is the most the company had ever made. So that was quite a year. A hard year to follow. In fact, in all of the years that followed, we didn't follow it.
No.
And I'll have to be the first to admit that. Mm-hmm. We did not follow it. Those are just extraordinary times. Mm-hmm. Extraordinary times. So
we hadn't talked about the exploration program continuing in any other countries, but that
yeah,
we're expanding into Australia.
And as you brought up earlier, in the 76, 77, 78 area, we had just gotten involved in Australia in the Kalgoorlie operations, which were a combination of quite a few different owners who had continued to consolidate their holdings into fewer and fewer entities. And so in 76, I think it was, Henry Colin was able to negotiate our partnership arrangement in Kalgoorlie. And the operations at that time included an underground, two underground mines. One of which was a stockwork that was able to be mined by mass mining techniques. They had large stopes that they would mass blast and then muck out from feeder holes with front end loaders, and were able to mine a tremendous amount of rock very inexpensively. It was low grade, but because it was so efficient, the mining was so efficient that it was very, very profitable to mine this low-grade ore. And I think it was probably no more than 3 grams to the ton, which is quite low for underground. But as I say, it was very efficient. So it really lent itself to low cost.
And were these mines that you acquired just from other?
Yes.
This
Kalgoorlie is an old mining district that was first developed just before the turn of the century, maybe 1895, around in there. And a tremendous gold field.
In the Hoover days, wasn't it?
And that's good. Edgar Hoover.
No, Herbert.
Sorry. You're right.
Excuse me.
No, you're right. Keep me on the right track here. Herbert Hoover graduated from Stanford in 96, I think it was, first graduating class, and as a mining engineer went to Australia.
All right. Okay.
But went to Australia via London. He was hired by this.
Okay.
just to pick up a thought again, he graduated from Stanford, first graduating class. Went to Australia via this mining house called Mooring and Pickering in London. And because he was just no more than 22 years old, if that, I think he grew a mustache so he'd look older, so he could get a, a more senior job with this mining house in London. Anyhow, they hired him, sent him to Australia, and he first landed in Kalgoorlie. And I can't remember which of the mines right in Kalgoorlie that he was associated with, but
shortly thereafter, he went north a little bit, east of Calgary, to the Sons of Goetia, which is a famous mine that runs today. The mine is still running today with the same name, and it's now a public company. But he was manager there for 5 or 6 years. And in the meantime, somewhere early in that period, he married his wife,
Lou Henry.
Thank you, Lou Henry, who was an extraordinary person in her own right, so well educated. But at any rate, they lived out in this really desolate area, which was 300 miles inland from the city of Perth on the western coast. All freight in that time was brought in by camels that had been brought over from Africa to carry freight up to the mines. They had to lay a 300-mile pipeline from the coast into the mines for potable and processed water. They had insurmountable obstacles that they surmounted. It was extraordinary stuff. But anyhow, these mines have operated continuously since that time under different managements. Originally, there were maybe 20 or 30 mining companies in Calgary. And over time, as gold prices waxed and waned, mines went broke, so the mines that were richer acquired the mines that went broke, and they kept consolidating the holdings in Calgary, which is probably about 5 miles long and a mile wide, that kind of area, on a slight hill. Because of the solidification of the rock, it eroded slower than the surrounding rock. But relatively flat country. So these mines continued to consolidate right on through the war, the Second World War, and subsequently. But with the gold price rise in 75 and 76, and then the fall, it fell away from the $200 that it reached in 76. These mines had all started up again, now under, I think, just two or three companies that were in partnership, one of whom was Western Mining. The retreat of the gold price made these mines uneconomic again, because at $200 they were economic. The gold price fell back to $100, and the old mines that had been reopened and were being mined by the old technique, which was mostly hand labor and small openings, they were now uneconomic. And the stockwork mine was economic, but not enough to carry the entire enterprise. So the owners of the several companies now that owned these tenements were looking for an outside investor. And so Homestake's guy, Henry Colon, showed up, looked it over, came back, reported to Paul, and Don Delicate, who was running the gold division at that time, what was going on, that this looked like an opportunity to get in for very little money in an old district that still had lots of reserves if the gold price would support it. And that was back in the days when Homestake was really looking to higher and higher gold prices, so that, in the future, the gold price would be high enough to make those reserves truly reserves instead of just a resource. So, Homestake wanted to make a proposal, the management did, took it to the board, and this, I had just joined the company months before this, so this was all new to me, and I wasn't in the boardroom, so I didn't hear any of this discussion, but the board felt that the investment was too risky, so didn't approve it, told Henry to go back and get a better deal. So Henry went back, got a better deal, and brought it to the board. I think this happened at least twice, maybe three times. They'd send him back again and come back with a better deal. So he finally came back, he came back with a better deal again, and so the board approved it. The deal was extraordinary. Homestake was to advance $3 million to the company. And
this was Western Mining?
Well, Western Mining was the manager. They didn't have as large a piece of it as the other company. I think it was KLV, Calgary, I forget what the L V standing for, but anyhow, KLV I think was the other partner in Western Mining. And so we came in as a 42% partner. KLV was a 42% partner, and Western Mining was a 6% partner, but they managed it. And as I recall, they didn't even get a management fee, but that may not be right. But in any case, for $3 million cash, we took that 42% position in this partnership. We were allowed to second a person to the operation to assist in returning the operation to profitability, and that person was Andy Anderson, O.E. Anderson.
Orville, I think.
Orville. And so Andy went over there and quickly assessed that the old underground operations, at these gold prices, there's no way they were going to make money. They had to be shut down. And so there was a lot of agonizing and so forth over that in Calgary, the town. But after some discussion, that was agreed to be done, with the proviso that when the gold price got above 250, I think it was, we would reopen those old workings. That was a condition of shutting them down then. And the Mount Charlotte, which was the stockwork operation, continued. And Andy had some good ideas that were helpful to them to further improve the efficiency of that operation, so that that became even more profitable, even at $100 gold. So that's and we invested $3 million in cash and were obligated to put in another $5 million to support the cash flow of the operation. And that was in the event that there was a further dip in the gold price, we'd put in another $5 million to support the now modified operation until the gold price went back up again, was the thinking. So we were obligated for a total of $8 million. We put in $3 million. Well, with these improvements that the people put in, and with a lot of help from Andy, they installed a crusher that was on the property somewhere, but in such an awkward place that it wasn't useful. They picked that up and put it in a place where it was useful, so the trucking was reduced on surface to get the rock to the plant and all that stuff. Just good stuff. Because these are all operations that have been built for this company and then built for that company, and then they put the two together, and they somehow they had two of these things, and instead of trying to rationalize these various physical pieces of equipment, they just sort of continued to sit where they were, and people didn't really think about it that hard enough. Well, they did think about that and really did streamline the handling of the material and materially improved the operation. And this all happened with this $3 million that we invested. Well, it's always better to be lucky than smart. Would you not believe that the gold price started to rise? Within several months of having consummated this deal, and Andy and the guys over there making these physical changes in the flow of the rock from the mine to the plant, so the gold price started to rise, and it became cash positive within 2 or 3 months instead of negative. So Andy and the Western Mining guys invested that in some more equipment to make it more efficient instead of just supporting the cash flow, because the cash flow was positive with a higher gold price and the lower cost. And so that operation never looked back. It never needed support for its cash flow from then till today, all these years later. So, you know, the story is, and the Western Mining not so much as the other people that were invested in it, said, "You stole this from us. You got this huge position for $3 million. That's terrible." Of course, they're envious that we were able to do that. But you see this plaque here. This is from the cities of Boulder and Kalgoorlie, from the mayors to us.
That's dated 1984.
Yeah. Well, I took the board over there in 1984. Uh-huh. And so we had the board meeting over there and introduced them to the city fathers and all that stuff. And so they presented this plaque for saving Kalgoorlie, because it was our $3 million investment that saved the city, that saved the town, that saved the mines.
They've got two towns there, Kalgoorlie and
Boulder. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the Shire of Boulder, the town of Calgary.
Yeah. Yeah, the Shire is the county here. Right. The, yeah, mm-hmm. the riding. For $3 million, all of those things happened.
Yeah.
And of course, we put a lot more money into it since that time, but to establish our then 42% interest in those tenements cost us $3 million.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have earned a tremendous amount of money there. We have reinvested a tremendous amount of money there. We're cash positive at home. In other words, we have brought home a lot more cash than we put into it by a long shot. But we reinvested a tremendous amount of money in the mines there. Now, a lot of things have happened since that time, and I guess maybe we'd ought to describe
maybe it's just continue with it.
What mm-hmm. what that is.
Mm-hmm.
So the mines took off. Gold price got over $250. Western Mining reminded us, and there's a guy named Brody Hall, whom you probably have met, Lee.
I remember the name.
Yeah. A crusty old Englishman that migrated to Australia as a young man and worked in the gold mines and became a senior executive for Western Mining. He was always reminding us how we were so cheap and how we got into this partnership with them, paid so little for it. We should be doing more, and we should contribute more, and all. And we took that. We listened to it, but we didn't do anything about it. Because, a deal's a deal. It was done on a fair basis. We could have lost our $30 million, or we could have lost our $8 million.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of thing that you always hope will work out, and it did it for us. But Western Mining, after a couple of years of things getting better, each year the gold price going higher, $300, $350, $400, so we reinstituted the old inefficient underground mines, making a little money at it, but had all these people working, which was good for the town. So it was towards the peak of the gold market that Western Mining only had 6% of the operation, 6% equity interest, and they, through another entity they owned, they had some more interest, but not very much, no more than 12 or 13% total. So they were really a minority owner, even though they managed the property and did a good job of managing it. But this was not a core property. This was not a core operation of theirs since it was so small. Their interest was so small. So somebody during this period of time, and it must have been Alan Bond, offered them Now, this is the Alan Bond of the America's Cup fame. The guy that took the America's Cup to Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And he was on a roll then and had invested in several different things in Australia, Western Australia, in real estate and other things. Made a lot of money, which gave him the opportunity to borrow more money because he never spent his own money. Didn't have any money, but had great ability to borrow money, which he did to the fullest. Alan Bond, in looking around Western Australia for things to invest in and do, bought North Kalgoorlie Mining, which was a small company that had some tenements immediately adjacent to the tenements that we held in our partnership. And his, we could have bought them, but we didn't think they had any potential. But he bought them. And then he made Western Mining an offer to buy their 6%. And so that really scared us because we were very happy to have Western Mining in there running it because they just didn't have any more interest than running that. They didn't want to take more interest. They were just happy in running it, and they were good managers, so we were happy with them. Now here's this guy with these tenements to the north of us that we didn't think had any real value, offering to buy the management. He thought he was buying the management. So we were on very good terms with Western Mining. Hugh Morgan he wasn't managing director yet. R.V. Parvel was still managing director, but Hugh was understudying and within a year or so became managing director. They came to us, R.V. and Hugh did it, and said, look, this Haybinder, this Alan Bond, is offering us a tremendous amount of money for our 6% interest. We can't believe what he's offering. And he said, look, you guys, look at our position. We got this small interest in this thing. We're putting good managers in here, our good managers, to run it. And this is all we get out of it. And this guy is offering us 50 times that to sell our interest. And so we said, oh God, we can't afford to pay that. And I said, of course you can. Nobody should pay that for it. But that's what he's offering us, cash. So we said, oh God, well, he can't buy the management of it. And he said, well, we've had our lawyers look at it. We don't know if he would buy the management. We say he can't. He can't be the manager. So, we're not trying to keep you guys from getting your money for your 6% interest. But we're telling you, he's not going to manage this. Property is too important to us. So they said, okay, we hear you. So anyhow, they sat down with Bond and negotiated a deal where he bought, and I can't remember the sum, but he paid an extraordinary sum of money for that 6% interest. And so then the next day after they shook hands and signed some papers, Bond is in the newspaper saying, I'm running cloud early. And so immediately we're on the phone with him saying, Mr. Bond, you're not running Calgary. We would like to see where you have the authority to run that. What papers do you have to show us? He said, well, you know, I paid all this money for it. Of course I'm running it. They were running it. I bought it from them. Now I'm running it. We said, no, you bought their interest, but you didn't buy the management of it. And so you're not going to manage it. So we toed and froed with.
Now, were you calling him directly?
Not a meeting. Directly, no. No. Let's see, who was doing that? Lee Graver. At that time, I can't remember who was calling him directly, and it probably was our lawyer. It probably would have been, and we hired an Australian law firm. Mm-hmm. We didn't try to read law from here, and so we had a firm who Langston would have directed, you know, that law firm, and I'm sure they were the ones that were doing the actual discussion with the Bond people, his lawyers, and perhaps with him even. Mm-hmm. So issue of management became a legal issue. Mm-hmm. And Bond, you know, went back to the Western Mining people and he said, I paid you this. Don't you say I'm a manager. And they said, no, we just sold you our interest. We didn't. There's no place in any of these papers that we said we're selling you the management. We don't have the management to sell you. These partners we had us as manager. But it isn't something that you buy and sell. Your partners determine who manages. One of them could, we could, whoever. So you didn't buy the management when you bought this, as far as we're concerned. So here he was, you know, crying to the press and everything. He had been built and all of that stuff. Well, he wasn't, because he assumed he was buying the management, but it was never conveyed to him by Western Mining or by the other two partners. So he finally, so he agreed that he didn't buy the management. He agreed that he got outfoxed and he didn't have the management. So his next move was to buy the other partner. I'm trying to recall how all this turned out, because we didn't want to have more than a 50% ownership, because it was an Australian operation. So we couldn't have bought the other partner, because that would have given us 90. What would be let's see, 42.
42 and 42.
42 and it must be 44 and 44, because that's 80. Well, anyhow, I know for sure Western Mining had 6%, so the other two, so that's 94 divided by 2 is 47, I guess. We said 47, so to add up to 100%. I've been saying 42% is 47%.
Okay.
So we couldn't buy them because that would give us 47%, and there, at that time there was some Australian law against owning more than 50% of an Australian enterprise. So we couldn't buy him, but Bond could, because he was an Australian. So he negotiated with them and bought that. So that plus his 6% then gave him, would have given him controlling interest over 50%.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we didn't want that to happen, so we entered into negotiation with him, and Lee Graver did this. And took his North Kalgoorlie mining tenements and our tenements, put them together, paid him, because now he owned more than 50%, paid him, I think it was $32 or $33 million. And we had the property 50-50. All of the tenements 50-50. And so and one other thing that was going on at that time was that this Bond, who knew nothing about mining whatsoever, picked up on the idea that we had had too, but had not the grand scale that this guy was thinking about, to open pit these tenements, because they kind of came right to surface. The old mines had mined right up to the surface from underground.
Mm-hmm.
Not open pit, but from underground. So there was, around each of these veins was a halo of lower grade, a gold ore that could be mined from the surface. So I can remember on one of my trips over there, before any of these things I just described happened, saying to John Roberts, who was running our Australian operations at that time, I said, John, you know, one day there were houses all around these mine shafts and everything, and sheds, and I said, you know, one day this is going to be an open pit. I said, look, all these openings here, and you sample the rock right around them, and it runs, well, gram, 2 grams, 3 grams. This will all be a pit one day. So we had thought of that too, but Bond said, we're going to build a super pit, and it is going to cover this whole 5 miles.
Mm-hmm.
The only trouble was he only owned just a little piece of it when he started out on this whole thing. And so when he bought our partner's share, now he owned a much bigger piece of it. And so that was the concept, that it'd be a super pit. Well, we were keen on that too, because we could see the potential for that. So that then became our incentive to get this guy corralled into a partnership where we had equal say, so that he couldn't do anything against our judgment on what the best way to extract the gold from this property was. So we wound up with this deal that I just described a minute ago, that we're 50-50. Well, it wasn't too long after that that Bond ran into hard times, and the banks started foreclosing on him because he just kept buying more and more stuff and all over the world and doing all kinds of things. He even bought the irises, the painting.
Oh, that's right.
From Sotheby's. $35 million, the most that had been paid for a painting. Van Gogh.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw it in his office in Perth. Oh. Here's this little old painting. He paid $35 million for it. It turns out Sotheby's gave it to him on credit. And he was paying them on time. Well, auction houses never do that. When that came to light 2 or 3 years later, they just had egg all over their face. But it was Alan Bond that bought it. Well, he was buying everything that way, with none of his own money. He borrowed it from the banker, got whoever he was buying, whatever it was, to pay